You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
My name is Paul Salem. I'm the Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. And I'd like to welcome you all on this rainy Friday to this panel on regional crisis and the war on ISIS. It doesn't just rhyme. They're also very interconnected, the regional crisis and the war on ISIS. We have an excellent panel today, all of our Middle East scholars and experts, to walk us through a number of the main issues. You have their bios with you, but I'll just mention briefly, and in the order that they will be making their opening remarks. We'll be starting with Ambassador Robert Ford to my extreme right, who I think is known to most of you. He's a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, but a long-serving and distinguished U.S., retired now U.S. Diplomat. He was our last ambassador to Syria. He was a deputy ambassador in Iraq. He served as ambassador to Algeria, served in Egypt, Bahrain, and many other places in the region. He's received the Presidential Honor Award and the Secretary of State's Distinguished Service Award. He will be starting off talking about sort of the Levantine regional dimensions of the deep crisis that Syria and Iraq and the enveloping region is going through, the conditions that enabled the rise and resurgence of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others. He will be followed by Charles Lister to my immediate right. Charles just joined us at the Middle East Institute, coming from the Brookings Center in Doha. Charles is the author of The Islamic State, a brief book published by Brookings, and just released a couple of weeks ago from Oxford University Press, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, The Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. And he's working on another book now on Jubhat al-Nusra, if I'm not mistaken. Works extensively on the Syrian jihadists, has great detailed knowledge there. He will be taking us into some of the fine detail of what's going on with those radical groups. He will be followed by the director of the Center for Turkish Studies at the Middle East Institute, Dr. Gönül Tol. Gönül is a prolific writer on Turkish affairs, an advisor and briefer in the U.S. She also writes regularly in the Turkish press, and she's been writing a weekly column for the newspaper Radikal, which she informed me was just closed down. She will be talking about the Turkish-Kurdish, the Turkish component of all of this, and U.S., what the U.S.-Turkish relationship has come to. As you know, President Erdogan has been in D.C. this week. And then she will be followed by Alex Vatanka. Alex is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute from Iran and focused on Iran, also a prolific writer on Iranian domestic affairs, Iranian foreign policy, Iranian regional policy. His book also came out recently called Iran and Pakistan, Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. And obviously Iran has a deep role in all of these issues, and he will walk us through that. I would like to thank the Office of the Minority Leader, Mrs. Pelosi, and the Office of Congressman Chris Van Hollen, who were instrumental in enabling us at Middle East Institute to hold this event here today. The format will be fairly simple. Each of my colleagues will make opening remarks of 7 to 8 minutes in succession. Then I will engage them in some question and answer discussion, and then we'll turn it over to the audience for questions to the panel as well. And we hope to end at 11 o'clock. At 11:30. Or 11 o'clock. It is 11 o'clock. All right. And we've asked each of our colleagues sort of in their remarks to do two things. One, to examine the issue that there, whether it's the Turkish issue or ISIS itself or the regional crisis, the elements, the dynamics moving forward. But importantly, to end their opening remarks with sort of policy reflections, recommendations for the U.S. We are here gathered in a U.S. lawmaking institution. We're addressing people concerned with U.S. policy and all this. Thank you all for coming, and I turn it over to Ambassador Ford if he'd like to come to the podium.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. It's nice to see a lot of people here on a Friday morning, and it's good to see some old friends and some old colleagues. I see my friend from Baghdad, Ambassador Richard Schmier, in the back there. Rich, I hope you're doing well. Let me speak for about 7-8 minutes on how I see developments in Syria and Iraq. And to me, the crisis in Syria and Iraq is getting more complicated, not less. There are some positive aspects, some good developments, but there are a lot of negative factors underlying even the progress, and I do have some policy recommendations that I want to talk about at the end. So on the positive side in Syria, of course, there is the cessation of hostilities, which is working far better than I had anticipated. I did not think it would do bring about a reduction in violence to the extent that it has. I was wrong. A lot of other analysts here in Washington and around the world were wrong, and we need to be upfront about that. Why? Why is it working better? I think the most important factor is that the two sides that have been fighting, the Syrian government on the one side and the Syrian opposition on the other side, are tiring. There have been 250,000 plus casualties, combatants and civilians together. Bashar al-Assad himself, at the end of last July in a national speech in Syria, said that the Syrian army was tiring, that it was having manpower problems. And we know that the Syrian armed opposition as well is tiring and is having its own manpower problems. And I think our very distinguished colleague, Charles Lister, may speak more about that. And there is pressure from the Russians as well on the Syrian government to reduce the scale of its military activities. But I underline the word reduce. I underline the word reduce. There are still attacks that the Syrian government is carrying out against not only the Islamic State, but also more moderate armed opposition groups, in particular in the eastern suburbs of Damascus, what is called the Eastern Ghouta. The Syrian government continues to attack that area, and it is continuing to block humanitarian assistance into those areas, into towns like Daraya and Madaya. These are significant violations of the cessation of hostilities, and as far as I can tell, there is no penalty applied to the Syrian government for what it is doing. The real question then about the cessation of hostilities, and I again underline that many of us were wrong about the extent to which it would reduce violence, and it has, but the real question going forward is, will the Syrian government push so far in places like the suburbs of Damascus that the armed opposition decides that it should respond on a more massive scale and open up fighting in other fronts? Let us hope that the cessation of hostilities does hold, but I underline that that's a hope. That's not a deep analysis. The hope, of course, is that there will be a political agreement, something which the United Nations and an international support group for Syria are trying to push forward. But I want to underline here that there has not been so much progress on that. I was at Geneva II, and it's certainly better than Geneva II. At least the Syrian government recognizes that it has to discuss political issues. It was completely unwilling to do that in January and February of 2014 at Geneva II. Now at Geneva III, it seems, whether it wants to or not, it seems that it recognizes that it must. But it's a long way from recognizing it needs to discuss it. That's a far distance from actually getting to a deal. A couple of key points. As the cessation of hostilities has eased the threat of aerial bombing, we have seen once again Syrians in rebel-controlled areas take to the streets, as they did in 2011 and 2012, demanding Assad's departure. Iskata Nizam is back. This just underlines that there is a strong element in the Syrian population that will not cut a deal that allows Assad to stay, certainly not easily. Second, the timeline that the international support group led by Russia and the United States has called for and that the United Nations is trying to apply is quite optimistic. They want a new constitution in Syria by this August. Let me say that again. They want a new constitution finished and approved in Syria by this August. Today is April 1st. That new constitution, I'm not going to go there. So Bashar al-Assad the other day said, oh, it'll be no problem getting a new constitution. And since Bashar al-Assad's government has never been governed by the rule of law, I don't think they're particularly concerned about the contents of a constitution. It's not a government that operates under any kind of legal strictures. There are human rights reports that have been written by Amnesty, by Human Rights Watch, by the State Department, by the European Union, speak for themselves. In addition, beyond that optimistic constitutional timeline, 6 months, next August, they're supposed to have elections in 18 months in Syria. And I just have to say, having worked on elections in Iraq during the civil war there, it is very hard to imagine a credible, free and fair election in Syria in 18 months. The whole security issue with the Islamic State, the Nusra Front, big challenge. How to register and enable refugees to vote, displaced people to vote. Half the population is displaced. The registration efforts and setting up voting, very hard, under the best of circumstances. And finally, the most important thing is, if the current government continues with its security apparatus, its four secret police services, who have delivered 99% votes for Bashar al-Assad and his father, Hafez, how are they going to have a free and fair election with that security apparatus still in place? If the answer from the international support group has been the UN will supervise. But I have to tell you, look at the UN's inability to get food into some of the places I mentioned, like Madaya and Daraya. If they can't even get bread and medicine into Madaya, how are they going to impose an election system on the Syrian secret police? That doesn't make sense. My own experience in Iraq is, if you have a government that cooperates with the UN can do great things. But if you have a government that blocks UN efforts, the UN is helpless. So if there is no deal on a new national government along the timelines that was set, it would appear to me that the country is headed, Syria is headed towards some kind of a partition. That leaves questions of who will manage rebel areas. Remember, these are not people that are trained accountants, engineers. They're going to need help. Is that help being arranged in a partition scenario, even a federal scenario? Where are the resources going to come from? How will you manage economic reconstruction in a heavily decentralized Syria? How will you do that? Finally, what to do about the Kurdish issue? They've declared an autonomous zone. And who is going to fight the Islamic State? These are big questions. Now, on the Iraq side of the border, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who I think is generally non-sectarian, I know him quite well, Haider has been trying to manage a very complicated three-way battle, the traditional one between Kurds, Sunni Arabs, and Shia. Haider is now trying to set up a new cabinet. He's having a very hard time. The competition between those ethnic and sectarian groups continues. Look at Diyala, look at Salah ad-Din. Anbar, I was just talking to a person who was there last week, said Anbar, the city of Ramadi, in order to save the city of Ramadi, they basically had to destroy it. That is not going to help promote national reconciliation unless there are resources to rebuild cities like Ramadi. So looking forward, what recommendations do I have for the administration? First, on the Syrian side of the border, please recognize Bashar al-Assad is not part of the solution. Bashar al-Assad is part of the problem. Second, think about the resources for how to govern areas under rebel control and how to find resources to rebuild. It is really important now, in places where civilians are rejecting extremists, such as in Idlib province, and I think Charles will speak about that, those civilians who are resisting extremists among their midst, they need help. They need help. And finally, on the Iraq side, we also should be promoting national reconciliation. That means the Americans need to push very hard to keep Shia militias that are politically motivated, politically motivated Shia militias out of Mosul. Out of Mosul. The Americans need to make sure that there is an agreement between the Sunni Arab inhabitants of Mosul and the Kurdish inhabitants of Mosul and the Kurdish regional government about how Mosul City will be governed. We aren't in Mosul yet. They aren't in Mosul yet. But they need to be working that out now, and they need, again, to be developing the resources to help whatever new civilian administration is set up. If you don't do that kind of planning now, and you don't marshal those kinds of resources now in Syria and Iraq, we are back to the same crazy scenario we had in 2003 in Iraq, where you can go in and liberate territory, but then what? So, Paul, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Ford. Very clear remarks and sticking more or less to time. That's fantastic. Charles, can I invite you to the podium?
Good morning, everyone. Okay, so Robert's laid down the gauntlet on timekeeping, which is not my strongest point. I have a lot to say, so here goes. The conflict in Syria and the socio-political power vacuums that have resulted from 5 years of horrific brutality and total nationwide chaos have provided the space for jihadists, Sunni jihadist militants to thrive. Upwards of 500,000 now reported dead, half of the population, that's 7 million people roughly, displaced internally and externally, catastrophic levels of destruction which will likely take 40 to 50 years at least to rebuild, and a government that has used chemical weapons, barrel bombs, unguided ballistic missiles, and many, many more. These are the kind of conditions that Sunni jihadist militants could only dream of operating in, and it's exactly what they've found in Syria in the last 5 years. So thanks in large part to Syria specifically, the organization we now know as ISIS or the Islamic State has grown into the global threat that it does represent today. ISIS's former Syrian wing, now an independent affiliate of al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, or the al-Nusra Front, is now arguably al-Qaeda's most promising affiliate anywhere in the world. In addition to those two organizations, which probably number roughly 20,000 fighters in Syria alone, there are approximately another 10 other transnationally minded jihadist organizations currently active on Syrian soil. Together, they probably number roughly 7,500 fighters in total as of today. So without wanting to exaggerate too much, Syria represents the Afghanistan of the 21st century, but on steroids. The scale of jihadist militancy in Syria is one thing. The capability that they have acquired in Syria is a whole other thing. Simply something that is, in at least in my opinion, unprecedented in modern history. With regards to ISIS specifically, we're now 20 months into coalition operations against that movement in Syria and Iraq. Roughly $6.5 billion has been spent, and over 11,000 airstrikes have been carried out. I believe the latest calculations suggest that roughly 40% of ISIS's territory in Iraq has been retaken since airstrikes began in August 2014. And approximately 20% of ISIS territory has been retaken in Syria. Now, those numbers would tend to suggest that we've made significant progress. We definitely have. The coalition has definitely made progress. What I would be keen on emphasizing, however, is that we're only just beginning to turn the corner in the fight against ISIS. And the reason why I say that is because the movement still retains control of all of its most critically valuable territories. And that, in Iraq, for example, I'm talking about places like Fallujah and Mosul. And in Syria, I'm talking about the city of Raqqa, its effective and de facto capital, and the province of Deir ez-Zor. I would also qualify by saying that we've just begun to turn a corner and not that we are defeating ISIS, in saying that in that 20-month space of time, ISIS has been provided or allowed the space to expand internationally. And whilst it does currently claim to have about 9 or 10 formal acknowledged affiliates around the world, two of those in particular now represent solid areas of strategic depth for this organization, namely in Libya and in the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. The coalition targeting of leadership has become a sort of cornerstone of coalition strategy, and it's certainly something that has been working particularly well in recent months. More than anything, it suggests a particularly heightened level of intelligence penetration within ISIS's senior circles in Syria and Iraq, and that in and of itself is a very powerful intimidator with regards to ISIS's feelings of internal security. adding to that, another part of that corner being turned is the intensified targeting of its financial infrastructure and its other sources of logistical networks. Recently, there have been reports from inside ISIS that its salaries that it's paying to its ordinary fighters have been roughly halved. To us, that might seem interesting, but internally, it actually appears to have significantly hit the organization's morale. There are more and more frequent reports, minimally reported in the media, but coming out of ISIS territory, of infighting, armed clashes breaking out in the middle of night in places like Raqqa between rival factions. These are all indications of a significant drop in morale and a decrease in internal cohesion. And the cohesion argument was always something that analysts like myself said was one of ISIS's strongest strengths. The last point I'll say, just in terms of framing today's situation with regards to ISIS, is about Mosul. There's been some media reporting today indicating or claiming that the operation to launch an offensive against Mosul has started. I would again be keen on emphasizing those operations are still roughly 90 kilometers from Mosul city itself. They're still on the other side of the Tigris River. We're a very, very, very long way, in my opinion, barring on any very dramatic incidents, of an actual operation on Mosul city. Certainly military officials here in Washington, D.C. and in Tampa in Florida have suggested a proper operation against Mosul city in and of itself won't start until early 2017. With regards to al-Qaeda in Syria, often ignored, Jabhat al-Nusra is not has not proven as a sort of dramatic and spectacular an attraction to the world's media, and certainly and undoubtedly, ISIS is posing more of a dramatic and immediate threat to Western security. And for that reason, it's understandable that ISIS is turning out to be our primary focus. Of all of my work on al-Qaeda in Syria and specifically on the al-Nusra front, I'm always keen on emphasizing this is an organization that has spent the last 5 years growing durable, deep roots in Syrian opposition and revolutionary society. ISIS, on the other hand, has shallow roots. It hasn't aimed to acquire popular support. It controls populations. Al-Qaeda has sought to grow not just acceptance, but in some areas of the country, support from the general population. And it's for this reason I say Al-Qaeda is playing a long game. This is part of a strategy that Al-Qaeda's senior leadership began to develop in 2009 and 2010. The idea of building alliances, beginning to impose the harshest forms of Sharia only years after entering certain strategic territories. This is something that for a long time has actually been seen to be paying off in al-Qaeda's favor in Syria, although events that Robert Ford mentioned in terms of Marat al-Numan, which is something I will talk about shortly, do lend some question to the long-term sustainability of al-Qaeda's strategy. Speaking very briefly, I have no idea how I'm doing time-wise. Geneva, the talks that we now see taking place in Geneva, these were largely prompted by Russia's military intervention in Syria in September 2015. And for that reason, the opposition at wide perceives the Geneva process as a Russian-driven process. So there's a certain level of skepticism and cynicism within the opposition about continuing in this process without any results being shown on paper. And so far, there are very little results. The armed opposition held three mass meetings in Turkey over the last 5 days. The first meeting, roughly 40 factions attended. They actually agreed to resume hostilities in Syria. I believe some of the more powerful factions then received phone calls from Saudi Arabia ordering them to not be so stupid. So they held a second meeting the following day and changed their mind. The third meeting took place, I believe, on Wednesday. And there they decided, their official line was, we will continue to support the opposition HNC negotiating team, but if we're attacked, we will retaliate. And in that sense, what Robert talked about earlier in terms of particularly intensifying strikes outside Damascus is a particularly worrying sign. Russia's intervention in Syria had three primary objectives. Firstly, rescue the Assad regime from the grips of defeat. This was an assessment that Russia and Iran made in the summer of 2015. That the Assad regime had between 3 to 6 months to survive. The secondary objective, that first objective, by the way, has been met. The secondary objective was to shore up an advanced negotiating position, not only for the regime, but more importantly for Russia itself. The third objective, and by the way, that second objective has certainly been met. The third objective was to begin to rehabilitate the Assad regime's reputation internationally as the only alternative to a terrorism-ridden Syria. And that is beginning, perhaps, to be met, especially with regards to the victory that the Syrian army, Hezbollah, Shia militias, the Iranian military, and a variety of other forces just won in Palmyra. Cessation of hostilities is a second consequence of Russia's intervention in Syria. Having achieved those first and second objectives, Russia pushed for the cessation of hostilities on the international or multilateral stage. In that sense, the cessation of hostilities had some certain objectives as well. First of all, most importantly for Russia, to facilitate the advancement of the political process itself with that strong negotiating position. Second of all, to give space for Russia to relaunch with the Syrian regime a refocused fight against ISIS and not against the opposition, having met that first objective of rebolstering the regime. And thirdly, the third objective was, in a sense, to provide space for Russia to announce a partial withdrawal of its military forces, again, to give it that much more of an advanced position, a negotiating position, but shift to a new phase of Syria operations for the Russian military. In that sense, I'd be keen on emphasizing, while it has withdrawn roughly half of its fighter jets from Syrian territory, it has deployed additional advanced attack helicopters to the country. In a military sense, that's just simply the starting of a new phase of operations, something which is much more targeted on retaking larger amounts of territory, potentially in urban areas, which points not just to operations against ISIS in places like Palmyra, but potentially also more long-term or medium-term to the opposition in places like Aleppo. So, as of regards those dynamics, I would actually, unfortunately, say that we should probably expect further regime gains against ISIS. Any gain against ISIS these days is a good one. Thank you. I knew that was coming. Any gain against ISIS is, of course, something to be lauded. My broader point here, when I say unfortunately, is that, as Robert said, the Assad regime staying in power is not the solution. It's not the solution for Syria, and it's certainly not the solution for defeating terrorism on Syrian territory. Last two things I will say. Firstly, on the transforming dynamics in Idlib, what's been fascinating from the cessation of hostilities is that it's revealed, for the first time, the biggest weakness in al-Qaeda's strategy in Syria, and that is that it is inherently dependent on a continued level of intense conflict in Syria. That intense conflict over the last 5 years has provided al-Qaeda with an opportunity to demonstrate its worth on the battlefield to the Syrian opposition and to the civilian support base. Without an intense level of conflict, the people came back to the streets and started chanting things which fundamentally object or fundamentally contradict al-Qaeda's stated objectives in Syria. So what happened? Al-Qaeda started cracking down on some of these protests in its strategic heartland of Idlib. And in one town in particular, Marat al-Numan, the stronghold of a Free Syrian Army group, which is vetted and supported in part by components of the US government, the 13th Division was essentially kicked out of town. That has now sparked 20 days in a row of protests by women, children, the elderly, and young men against Jabhat al-Nusra's control of Idlib. This is something we've never seen before, and it's a huge opportunity to undermine al-Qaeda's long-term future in Syria. Unfortunately, as of now, there's very little that we as the West have done to take advantage of this. But I would continue to stress this is the first time this opportunity has arisen, and it won't be there for very long. Al-Qaeda has taken a step back. It has refused to subjugate these protests so far. If it does, and it will one day choose to do so, those protests will end like that, and they'll probably never come back again. So I cannot emphasize enough the opportunity that stands ahead of us in that respect. And to conclude, I've been asked to make a few policy recommendations. The first one with regards to ISIS. We have, as I say, turned a corner in the fight against ISIS in its Syria and Iraq heartlands. In that respect, that fight needs to be accelerated, and in particular, the military fight. Four policy recommendations in that respect. Firstly, the cessation of hostilities needs to be reinforced and, as much as possible, guaranteed by the international community. At the moment, it's a kind of, we'll see what happens tomorrow, and hopefully it will continue to be in place. If we can solidify the cessation of hostilities more long-term, we will expand the breadth of actors willing to fight against ISIS. And in that, I'm talking about the more mainstream and conventional Syrian opposition. Second policy recommendation for ISIS is to encourage, and this is an important one, encourage and facilitate dialogue and mediation between the mainstream opposition and the Kurdish YPG. This is an extraordinarily problematic dynamic that has exploded in northern Syria. If things continue as they are, I genuinely fear we might be starting to see the start of an entirely new political, not ethnic, conflict breaking out in northern Syria that may well outlast the conflict between the opposition and the regime. Only dialogue and mediation can solve the kind of hostility that now exists between these two parties. Thirdly, contribute towards bailing out the KRG and its dire economic situation. The Kurdish Peshmerga have proven to be very reliable partners in the fight against ISIS in northern Iraq, but their extraordinary financial difficulties are restraining the extent to which they can contribute towards the fight for Mosul and other areas around, and that must necessarily be fixed. And finally, and fourthly, with regards to ISIS, we must continue to target its senior leadership to demonstrate that intelligence penetration I talked about earlier, and to continue to target and undermine their financial and logistical networks. With regards to al-Qaeda, again, we need to ensure the continuity of the cessation of hostilities so that that opportunity to undermine al-Qaeda's long-game strategy in Syria can be further undermined. Secondly, we need to enhance assistance to and provide, and to protect our vetted assets on the ground. The 13th Division is an obvious example there. They were defeated in parts of Idlib over roughly 2 days, and we've done nothing to protect them. This is an organization that we have been providing support, along with Saudi Arabia and a number of other regional countries, for the last 2.5 years. But as soon as they're attacked, we just stood by and watched. This is not the right message to be sending to our assets on the ground. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly for the long term, we need to begin to empower in tandem civil councils, the judiciary, and vetted armed opposition groups. And in that meaning, I mean, for a long time, support appears to have been given in isolation to civil councils, to select judicial systems in liberated territories, and to armed opposition groups. In reality, those three things are inherently linked on the ground. So long as we provide them support in isolation, if one fails, the other two weaken. But if the three are working together, they provide that much more of a solid basis to combat the ideology of extremism in places like Idlib, where this opportunity is currently present. In that, I hope I've provided some space for question and answers in the following session.
Thank you very much, Charles. An excellent presentation. Gonul, the podium is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Today, I will be talking about Turkey's relationship with its own Kurds, which I believe is one of the main drivers of Turkey's Syria policy and also plays a very important role in Turkey's relationship with the United States. President Erdogan is in town, and that's his main topic in his discussions with American officials, that the United States' relations with the Syrian Kurds. So that's why I would like to focus on the Kurdish question. For decades, Turkey's conflict with its Kurds has hindered Turkey's democratization. But unfortunately, neither Turkey's democratization nor the Kurdish quest for political rights have occupied an important place in Washington's relations with Ankara and also the Kurds. Turkey's democratic shortcomings have been ignored by U.S. administrations for the sake of greater geostrategic interests, and in a similar fashion, the Kurdish rights have been overlooked in the game of power politics. But I believe today's regional context ties Turkish democracy and particularly Turkey's Kurdish question and the peaceful resolution of Turkey's Kurdish question to the U.S.'s strategic interests in the region. You all know, Turkey still considers the PKK a terrorist organization, and also its the PKK-linked PYD in Syria, a terrorist organization and a bigger threat than the Islamic State. And therefore, Ankara has not really played the effective role that Washington has been seeking from its NATO ally in the fight against the Islamic State. Turkey, although recently stepped up its efforts in the anti-ISIS coalition, at times Ankara worked at direct odds with the U.S.'s anti-ISIS strategy. By targeting Washington's most effective allies on the ground, which is the PYD, the Syrian Kurds. In October, for instance, Turkey confirmed that Turkish military attacked the Syrian Kurds after the Kurds captured the northern Syrian town of Tel Abyad. And Turkey's refusal to engage the Syrian Kurds, I believe, also complicates the UN talks on ending the Syrian conflict. Recently, for instance, Turkey has warned the United Nations and the United States that it will walk out of the political process if the PYD is invited to the talks in Geneva. And as a result, the UN envoy decided not to invite the PYD. And I believe the exclusion of the Syrian Kurds from future meetings is likely to complicate efforts to find a political solution, because they are the most powerful Kurdish faction and they control almost 10% of Syria. If Turkey fails to find a peaceful resolution to its own Kurdish problem, Ankara will keep attacking the Kurds, rendering U.S. strategy against the Islamic State less effective and derailing the political process. But unfortunately, the prospects for both the government and the Kurds to de-escalate the conflict remain slim in 2016. And let me just give you a brief background on where Turkey stands on the Kurdish question. In 2012, the government launched another initiative, Kurdish Opening, in an effort to grant more rights to the Kurds, and an agreement was reached between the PKK and the Turkish state. So the broad outlines of the agreement between the PKK and the state included a ceasefire declaration by the PKK and the withdrawal of the PKK into northern Iraq. And in return, the Turkish government promised that it would carry out reforms to address the Kurdish demands. So as part of the settlement talks, the PKK started withdrawing from Turkish territory in 2013. But shortly after that, the PKK halted the withdrawal, citing concerns that Turkey did not hold up its end of the deal. The Turkish government did not carry out the promised reforms. But still, the ceasefire between the state and the PKK held until July 2015, when the PKK killed two Turkish policemen in retaliation to the killing of more than 30 Kurdish activists in a suicide bombing carried out by an ISIS member. From the PKK's perspective, this was just another indication that the state was collaborating with the Islamic State. And the ruling party used this as an opportunity to weaken the pro-Kurdish party and also to appeal to the nationalists. So the ceasefire broke down and the government responded with a very heavy-handed military campaign in city centers and imposed curfews on major Kurdish towns. So since July, more than 200 Turkish soldiers have been killed, and the army says about 500 PKK militants have been killed, and 100 of them were civilians. And neither party seems willing to back down. The government vows to push on with the operations until, the president's words, the fighters are annihilated. And in an equally determined statement, the PKK has vowed revenge over civilian deaths. And there are three factors that make the parties unwilling to de-escalate the conflict. The first one is both the government and the Kurds, they have hardened constituencies. On the one hand, you have a very ethnically nationalist base of the ruling party. On the other hand, you have a very emboldened, very radical young Kurdish generation who is not willing to settle down for cosmetic changes. And the second reason why both parties are not going to back down, President Erdogan He has this dream of switching to a presidential system. And because of this dream, the government is in a constant electoral mood, which makes resuming negotiations with the Kurds politically very risky, because his base demands that he keeps hitting the Kurds, and that's very popular. And finally, and I believe the most important factor, is what's been happening in Syria. The developments in Syria have heightened Turkey's fear of a PKK-linked autonomous region, independent Kurdish entity on its doorstep. And that fear played an important role in Ankara's return to a military approach to the Kurdish question. Because, after all, this is a government that launched two Kurdish initiatives, one in 2009, one in 2012. So everyone thought that it finally had come to terms with the fact that the Kurdish question in Turkey was not just a military problem, but the government had to address the socioeconomic dimension of the problem as well. But today we are at a point where the government sees this purely as a terror threat. And I believe what's been happening in Syria played a major role in that, because Turkey has become increasingly uneasy with about the emergence of yet another Kurdish entity on its southern border. After the Syrian Kurds, they established autonomy in northern Syria. And of course, another factor that contributed to Turkey's fear was the boost, the military and diplomatic boost that the Syrian Kurds have been receiving from the West because of its effective fight against the Islamic State. So these groups, they've basically become the West's best hope for on-the-ground troops to counter ISIS. And of course, adding to Turkey's concerns has been the Russian military buildup in Syria. Moscow's direct military involvement in the Syrian civil war and also the tension in Ankara-Moscow relations after Turkey downed a Russian jet have led to a closer cooperation between the Syrian Kurds and Russia. And several times, Russian President Putin offered to help the Kurds consolidate their territorial gains in northern Syria by linking the Kurdish-held town of Kobani with Afrin. So these contributed to Turkey's fears, and because of those factors, I don't think the PKK or the government will be willing to resume negotiations anytime soon. And in fact, the fighting is likely to intensify in the spring when more PKK militants return from their winter bases in northern Iraq. And just 2 days ago, I've actually seen a picture posted by PKK commanders of PKK militants returning from northern Iraq to Turkey. So that means that the fighting will certainly intensify. And that escalation, I think, of course, it will have domestic implications for Turkey, but that escalation will undercut U.S. efforts to counter ISIS and pursue a political solution to the conflict in Syria, and also promote an inclusive government in Iraq. If Turkey doesn't, without a rapid political solution to the Kurdish problem, Turkey will remain an ineffective partner in the fight against ISIS and derail not just military but also diplomatic efforts to find a solution to the Syrian conflict. And to secure Turkey's full cooperation both in Syria and Iraq and the fight against ISIS, I think the United States must use its leverage to push both parties to return to the negotiating table. And when I raised this issue in my former meetings with members of Congress, they always asked the same question. Do we actually have leverage? And I believe, yes, the United States has leverage both over Ankara and over the PKK and the Syrian Kurds. U.S. cooperation with the PYD has been crucial for the Syrian Kurds because it boosted them diplomatically and militarily. And Washington has influence over Ankara as well. And more than it had a few months ago. After the crisis with Russia, and the chaos in the region, Turkey has rediscovered its Western allies. It's quite isolated in the region, and it feels threatened by Putin's actions. It's almost now surrounded by Russia, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey doesn't have they have horrible relations with all these countries. So Turkey now values its NATO membership and Western partners more than ever, which gives the U.S. more leverage over Ankara. And in my personal opinion, the U.S. could use both Ankara's current vulnerability and also its isolation in the region and several trust-building measures to secure Ankara's cooperation. As a trust-building measure, for instance, the U.S. could redeploy Patriot missile batteries in Turkey. And I believe that would ease some of Ankara's security concerns stemming from Syria and also show Ankara that the United States is committed to Turkey's security. And Washington could also eliminate another sticking point in U.S.-Turkey relations. Turkey has long opposed engaging the PYD, arguing that it is linked to the outlawed PKK and also that the PYD fights alongside the Assad regime. And if Washington can convince the PYD, the Syrian Kurds, to take a clearer stance against the Assad regime, I think it might be relatively easier for Ankara to drop its opposition to the Syrian Kurds' involvement in the political process. And the PKK also sees the conflict in Syria through the lens of what's happening, the conflict in Turkey through the lens of what's happening in Syria. The U.S. PYD cooperation in Syria, therefore, is very crucial for the PKK's strategic calculations. And the United States, I think, could use that leverage to pressure the PKK to de-escalate the conflict. Because for the PKK, the bigger fight, and as Turkey analysts, we tend to disagree with that. But I think that for the PKK, the real show is Syria. What is happening in Turkey, the fight against the Turkish state, is just a sideshow. Now, all Kurds that I've talked to in Turkey, they focus mostly on what's happening in Syria. And they think that this is a historic moment for them, and they want to seize the opportunity. And that's why I think U.S.'s relationship with the Syrian Kurds is very important for the PKK. So I think if the United States could use that leverage to pressure the PKK to de-escalate the conflict, this could give Ankara a face-saving way to de-escalate its heavy-handed military operations as well. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gönül. Alex, can I invite you to the podium?
Morning, everyone. I promised to be quick. I was asked to talk about the impact of the nuclear deal on Iran's regional behavior. Did it soften Iran's behavior in the region? And the answer to that, when I look back at it now, the deal was signed 14th of July, 2015. When I look back at it, I really see two answers in my head. One is on secondary issues, yes, it has softened Iran's behavior somewhat. Or put even more accurately, it has led Iran's neighbors to be more willing to work with Iran. But on the more hardcore security issues, and Syria certainly falls into that category, I was struggling to find reasons of optimism and say, actually, the nuclear deal had an impact, that the Iranians have softened their stance. Sure, you can point to the fact that now Iran, since I believe November of last year, has been part of the political process on the future of Syria, the fact that they're involved. Well, that is good news, I guess, if you're sitting in Tehran. But what does it mean in terms of Iran's willingness to push Assad to either leave the political stage, which most analysts seem to agree is basically at the end of the day what has to happen for Syria to be able to look for a political solution to this civil war. Iranians haven't done that. To this day, they're still committed basically to Assad. They play lip service to some sort of a transition at some point. But in effect, they're saying it's Assad's call. So, but let me take you back to Tehran. And let me try to describe to you where Syria fits in the big power struggle that's happening right now in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Because I think that's a key factor that we ought to remember when we talk about how does Iran come up with its policies in the region. Syria definitely is one of those issues that needs to be examined in this context. So take yourselves back to 2013. This fellow by the name of Hassan Rouhani comes in and says, we need a nuclear deal to the supreme leader of the land, Ayatollah Khamenei, to the generals in the Revolutionary Guards. We need a deal because the deal will enable us to go back in and become basically a mainstream country. That is the promise of Hassan Rouhani. He backs it up with also statistics why the Iranian economy couldn't do without a deal. And the generals and the supreme leader, you could say reluctantly, but regardless, went along. The deal is signed. It's implemented in January of this year. 75 days later, if you look at that Iranian debate in Tehran, the critics of Rouhani are saying, what did you actually get us? Where is the real sanctions relief? We've had over 200 foreign delegations come to Tehran since July of last year, billions of dollars being promised in investment in Iran and all the rest of it, but in fact, the sanctions are still in place. What they're referring to is obviously the United States hasn't really done, in their view, enough to remove the concerns out there in the banking community around the world to facilitate trade and investment with Iran. That seems to be the key obstacle, which has killed the whole enterprise around this nuclear deal. So there's a nuclear deal if you're sitting in Tehran, but in fact means nothing for them. I say this because this is critical. This was supposed to be Rouhani's key policy achievement, and it's failed so far. So his critics in Tehran are saying, should he ever bring Syria up, should he ever dare to say that the generals, the likes of Qasem Soleimani and Mohammad Ali Jafari, the head of the Revolutionary Guards, we need to rethink our strategy in Syria, they would say, hang on a minute here. Why don't you go ahead, finish what you started with the nuclear deal first before you start suggesting more compromises on a sensitive issue like Syria, which is another very interesting part of what's happening in Iran. In 2013, Rouhani, the presidential palace, and the foreign ministry were given the task to go out there and get a nuclear deal and get the sanctions lifted. As I said, they're struggling right now. They're struggling right now because it's not working out the way they thought it would work out. The regional policy from 2013 onwards was meant to be in the hands of the Revolutionary Guards and continues to be in the hands of the Revolutionary Guards, who do not have the same aspirations and hopes in improving relations with the West. They simply don't look to the West the way Rouhani looks to the West. So put yourself in that situation, and if you're Rouhani, would you today approach the Supreme Leader's office and the Revolutionary Guards and suggest that we ought to rethink our Syria policy? What I'm saying is whatever Iran has done, and you will hear more in the QA session, have you already heard plenty, whatever Iran has done in Syria, in my view, will continue to be basically the approach. I don't think Hassan Rouhani is going to be the guy Washington can call and say, can you please notch it down a bit in Syria? Can you perhaps rethink your policy? Hassan Rouhani domestically is not in a position in Tehran to chase anything like that. To give you just one recent example, this week we had Hassan Rouhani's mentor, the former president Ayatollah Rafsanjani. He came out and he said on his Twitter account, the era of missiles is over. The future is about talks and negotiations. Literally within hours, the Supreme Leader comes out on live TV and says, those people who make claims like that are either imbeciles or traitors. I just want to show you how hot this debate is in Tehran. And what that means, in effect, for someone like Hassan Rouhani, what limited options he has. He might sit there right now in Tehran and say to himself, what's happening in Syria is to the disadvantage of Iran in the long term. But politically, when you think about the fact that he's a guy who's looking ahead to next year's re-election campaign for himself in 2017, here's a guy who is faced with a supreme leader who's 77 years old, who might leave the stage at some point soon, and the succession crisis around his departure has already started. The various factions are gearing up to basically go out there and see who can put their individual in the supreme leader's office. In this political environment in Iran, you have to look at Syria as an issue that is simply too sensitive for the likes of Hassan Rouhani to touch. So let me say a few words about some of the key countries when it comes to Syria in Iran's policy. And then, as Paul said, maybe a couple of words about U.S. policy recommendations. Look at Iran's relations with Russia. It's Hassan Rouhani who's looking to the West, who is basically in many ways fallen in love with the promise of the West helping him, his government, and Iran out of the isolation it's been so much. The Revolutionary Guards generals don't look at it that way. If they're looking for an external partner they want to tie themselves to, in today's world, at the moment, it happens to be Russia, and lesser extent, China. But in reality, both sides, both the moderate faction around Rouhani and the hardliners in the Revolutionary Guards, and you could argue the Supreme Leader's Office, while they talk about a lot of cooperation, strategic closeness with the Russians, in reality, plenty of suspicion stays in relations between Iran and Russia. And I would include even about the future of Syria. I think it's naive of us to think the Iranians are sitting there and hoping Russia will win the day for them in Syria and they can come in and basically continue where they left off in early 2011. Now, that's not the view in Iran. The view in Iran is if Russia is not challenged in Syria, they will be the winners in a country where Iran actually invested a heck of a lot more since 1979 than Russia has done since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91. So they're actually competing with the Russians. Obviously, that's not the rhetoric you hear, but that's the suspicion. What does that do in practical sense? I think what that potentially could enable for the United States to do is to take advantage of those Iranian suspicions about Russia's intentions in Syria and push the Iranians in a direction of a political solution that the Iranians might be uncomfortable with, but if cast next to a Russian-dominated Syria, might be a better solution for them. Quickly, a few words about Turkey. Gunil described Iran's relations with Turkey in probably more stark terms than I would, and in relations certainly are not good, but I can tell you, of all Iran's immediate neighbors, if there's one country Iran cannot do without, certainly economically, that would be Turkey. The Iranians cannot afford economically to walk away from Turkey, and they don't care necessarily that are involved in a proxy war with the Turks in Syria. They can live with that. And there's all sorts of speculation that Iran even wants to mediate between the Russians and the Turks. Visits have been made and so on. What I'm saying, the Turkish hostility with Iran, at least from Iran's vantage point, is something that can be overcome. Iran's differences with Syria, I'm sorry, with Saudi Arabia, much harder to overcome. Much harder to overcome. And as with the Syrian question, that Rouhani cannot afford to touch, nor can he touch the Saudi issue, is simply too nuclear reactive, as they say. He cannot afford to reach out to Saudi Arabia any more than he has done. That's just not the atmosphere in Tehran. On the other hand, the Revolutionary Guards folks actually seem to be very comfortable with Saudi Arabia being Iran's big external foe. It gives them something to fight for, and it really helps the domestic nationalist narrative, which they cultivate constantly inside Iran by pointing to Saudi Arabia, say, if we don't fight these people and the ones they support in Syria, tomorrow they'll be bringing their message of anti-Shiism to the borders of Iran. That's the message they're playing at inside the borders of Iran. A couple of quick points, and I promise to finish, Paul. They say Iranians dominate Lebanon. That might be true, but I can tell you I'm not going to dominate this Lebanese man. So I will be quick. So basically what I'm saying is if I'm the Obama administration, don't expect favors from Rouhani. He can deliver. Right now he cannot deliver in Syria. And for the reasons I pointed out, because of the pickle he is in domestically back home. That's why if I was United States, and going by the president's interview with The Atlantic, which seems to indicate that's something he obviously has in the back of his mind is to push for some sort of a escalated efforts towards regional compromise on the issue of Syria. And I know it might come across as naive, but there are two countries here, Iran and Saudi Arabia, that really are not being pushed by the United States to talk. They need to talk, and I think they will be willing partners, both in Tehran and Riyadh, to, at some point, begin that process. I think that's critical when we're talking about the future of Syria. But final point, this creates a dilemma for the United States. If Rouhani can't deliver, who do we talk to in Tehran? That's the question you have to answer. Is the United States willing to sit down, like it did in 2007, with the generals from the IRGC and talk? Those talks in Iraq didn't come to much. But that's one of those big questions that you need to, if you are sitting in Washington, to sort of think about. Because obviously, as you all know, United States relations with the Revolutionary Guards isn't just about Syria. It contains a host of other issues, which makes it very complicated. But if you really want to tackle the elephant in the room, you have to have some sort of answer to that question. With that, I'll stop.
Thank you to all the panelists. Very, very rich presentations. Prepare your questions or formulate them in your mind if you wish. I'm going to shoot the quick questions to the panelists and then turn it over to the audience. Let me turn to you first, Ambassador Ford. Couple of questions. Are we at the beginning of a new phase in Syria where the regime and possibly the rebels will seriously turn to fight ISIS, partly because there is a cessation of hostilities, so they have free capacity. There is a cessation of hostilities, so they can't go after each other. We've just seen the Assad regime choose to take Palmyra, although they maybe could have done it earlier. Do you see a gathering dynamic there, a movement against ISIS in Syria? And if that is the case, what recommendations, how can the U.S. deal with these very contradictory players? You have the Kurds, you have the rebels, you have the regime, you have Turkey. Is there a way to, square the circle with all these different players and move forward in order to defeat ISIS sometime in 2017 in Syria?
Paul, I think we might be at a new phase in Syria, but not in the way you've described. Mm-hmm. I don't think it at all likely, and I defer to Charles, who I think talks more to the armed opposition than I do these days, but I do not think the non-jihadi armed opposition in Syria is even close to allying with Bashar al-Assad's remaining Syrian government forces against the Islamic State. I think it's really important for people in Washington to remember that Bashar al-Assad's forces have killed 7 times more civilians than the Islamic State has killed. 7 times more. And so those, what I call moderate or nationalist, others call them, those armed opposition groups view Assad as the main enemy, Absolutely. Not the Islamic State. And I don't think that's going to change. Even the cessation of hostilities does not change that. The only reason the American Defense Department now is getting some traction recruiting some, I don't want to overstate it, but a few thousand Arab fighters in eastern Syria is they have dropped the ridiculous demand that any equipment they receive from the Americans never be used against the Assad government. The previous train and equip program, the one which failed abysmally, required that pledge, and as a result, the Defense Department was able to get very few recruits, only a couple hundred. So they've dropped that, and they're doing better. But that tells me there will be no alignment between the Syrian government, if it remains under Bashar al-Assad or his circle, and the armed opposition.
If I may, I mean, my question is not whether they will align with each other, but will the rebel opposition move against ISIS in any significant areas, regardless of what the Assad? Are we in a period when that can be contemplated?
They've been fighting the Islamic State since 2013. And what's bizarre to me, really bizarre, is that we have provided almost no help to them. This is a very strange thing. I keep seeing in the American media that the Kurds are our best allies against the Islamic State, the Syrian Kurds. And there is no question that Syrian Kurds have fought the Islamic State very hard. But the Syrian Kurds are the only ones who've ever received close combat air support. It's really much easier to prevail against the Islamic State if you have American close combat air support. Other rebel groups fighting up around Aleppo, for example, some of them Islamist, some of them not, have not received close American combat air support or have only in the number of instances you could count on one hand. And so until that changes, until the Americans start to think and look at those people as real allies, the fighting between those moderate armed opposition groups and the Islamic State will continue, but it won't be able to make the same kind of progress that Syrian Kurdish-led forces have been able to make in the East.
Thank you, Robert. Charles, you've researched and written a lot about the old and deep relationships between the Assad regime and the jihadist networks before the uprising and somewhat in it. The Assad regime, after enabling, ignoring at best ISIS for all this for 3 years, pivoted and took Palmyra. What do you think, you know, elicited that kind of, you know, change of strategy? Is it a one-off? Do you think they have an interest in continuing? Many people have said, you know, if ISIS is defeated, they will lose a lot of their legitimacy. What do you see the regime's game with ISIS after Palmyra?
Thanks, Paul. Is this working?
Yes.
I think, you know, answering both Robert's question and this one is very easy. It's all a question of priorities. The Assad regime from 2013 until from last week or the week before, from when Palmyra really intensified, there was a very significant space of territory, a space of time, roughly 18 months, where the Assad regime virtually totally ignored ISIS. Now, it wasn't entirely doing that because they're not working hand in hand. But the Assad regime had a prior interest in fighting the opposition, which was its more immediate threat. Today, the balance has shifted, and as I said in my presentation, because the political track has intensified to the extent that it has, and because the cessation of hostilities is now in place, the Assad regime has the resources and the political interest in intensifying its own fight against ISIS. The victory in Palmyra, you need only look across international newspapers. I mean, the reporting was clear. This was a big regime victory in a very, very, very symbolic location. They were not only defeating ISIS in a big town, but they were rescuing a UNESCO heritage site, et cetera, et cetera. So there was an extremely significant political interest in demonstrating for the first time in 18 months that not only was the regime interested in fighting ISIS, but that it could do so with Russian air support as well, I would add, and with Russian ground forces. Whether or not they're paramilitaries or special forces is still unclear at this point. So it's a question. It's just a question of interest. And as I said again in my presentation, I think if the cessation of hostilities stays in place, or at least the dramatic reduction in hostilities stays in place, I would expect the regime to continue to try and make advances. They're aiming towards two towns now, Karyatayn, and also Al-Sukhna in the Homs Desert. And both of those are particularly valuable strategically for ISIS, and I think it's probably inevitable that the regime within current dynamics will eventually take those too. The trap that the West cannot fall into is now thinking that ISIS therefore represents our best hope in fighting against terrorism in general in Syria. Because I can promise you, if he ends up being victorious against ISIS, Al-Qaeda in particular will thrive like we've never seen before. I mean, we think they might represent a threat now. My God, they will gain thousands and thousands and thousands of recruits if we end up turning and siding with the Assad regime. And just quickly on the opposition point, if I may, I think, yes, I mean, certainly there's no way that the opposition is going to side with the Assad regime anytime soon. What has been interesting, however, is that with the cessation of hostilities in play, the opposition north of Aleppo has dramatically intensified its fight against ISIS. And actually, coalition airstrikes have come in to back them in some of those cases. Just in the last week, there have been, albeit small numbers, but much more than we would have seen in the last year or so, coalition airstrikes around north of Aleppo. And the opposition is, for the first time, actually looking like they're winning, albeit on a small scale, against ISIS on that front line. And it's also worth remembering, if we're talking about, you know, the most capable actors, not only in defeating ISIS on the battlefield, but then in holding, it is the mainstream opposition. If we go back to, as I will say probably every time I speak publicly, from 1st of January 2014 until the 1st of March 2014, so roughly 2 months of time, the mainstream opposition defeated ISIS in 4.5 provinces in 8 weeks. Now, we're talking about the Kurdish YPG being our best ally in the fight against ISIS. They've taken roughly two-thirds of a combined province in 20 months with US air support. So we're sort of losing a trick here in terms of who can most genuinely fight successfully against ISIS. The problem is the priority. So long as the Assad regime remains in place, the vast majority of the opposition today, as compared to 2014, don't have that immediate priority in fighting against ISIS.
Thank you, Charles. Gonul, you laid out sort of very clear recommendations as how to try to diffuse the contradictions between the Turkish and the PKK situation and what the U.S. can do about it. I want to add another question there, that Turkey has accepted Kurdish empowerment and autonomy in northern Iraq, which initially one would have thought, and initially they were very much against, but now Erbil is almost an ally against the PKK to a large degree and against Iran and others in Baghdad. So that's a surprising sort of development. So my question relates to the, you know, Turkish potential attitudes towards Kurdish autonomy in northern Syria. Obviously, to the degree that it empowers the PKK, if the PKK is still in this hot conflict, that would be bad. But if one takes the Iraqi model, in which sort of autonomy in northern Iraq enabled a very different relationship with Ankara, do you see that as a potential area where the U.S. and Turkey could explore?
Yes, you're right. Turkey has a completely different relationship with the Kurdistan regional government. But the KRG, for the Turkish government, the KRG represents the good Kurds, meaning that there's always been tension between the Iraqi Kurds and the PKK. And Turkey's main problem is the PKK-linked groups. So if you ask Erdogan, for instance, when he was speaking at Brookings yesterday, whether what was the main problem with the Kurds, he would say, we don't have a problem with the Kurds. We're fighting against the PKK. So we have a problem of an autonomous, I mean, we are concerned about an autonomous Kurdish region in northern Syria because the Syrian Kurds are linked to the PKK. And Turkey went further than having good relations with the Kurdistan regional government. By signing energy deals, Turkey almost laid the foundations of an independent Kurdistan. So Turkey's thinking was, as long as the Iraqi Kurds are dependent on me, they won't pose a threat. And as long as they have this tension with the PKK. So your question about whether Turkey could have similar relations with the Syrian Kurds, I don't think, especially, I mean, if Turkey cannot resolve its own Kurdish problem, that's what I was trying to say in my presentation. If Turkey fails to find a peaceful resolution, it will focus on marginalizing the Syrian Kurds. And it will always be fearful of an autonomous Kurdish region in northern Syria. So the key here is for the Turkish government to address the Kurdish demands. And of course, I don't think that the main reason for the breakdown of the ceasefire was not, I think both the PKK and the government are to blame here. So there are steps that the Turkish government has to take, but also there are steps that the PKK has to take. The PKK and especially Turkey's Kurds, they feel very emboldened. So they're less willing to compromise. And that is the problem. And as long as that is the case, as long as there's fighting going on inside Turkey, I don't think Turkey will be comfortable with Syrian Kurds gaining ground in Syria.
Thank you, Gonul. Alex, I mean, we just talked with Charles and Robert about Assad's turn against ISIS in Palmyra. You know, the first time really they've actively, aggressively engaged ISIS. My question is, do you sense that there is an appetite, a support, any seriousness in Iran for Iran to be deeply engaged in taking the fight to ISIS, for example, in Syria, which will require a lot of sacrifices, a lot of money and so on. When I was in Tehran a couple of months ago, I was struck by statements by government officials who said, we will do anything to protect Damascus or Baghdad, but we're not going to be taking the fight to ISIS. That's your problem, meaning right. You, the U.S., and your allies. But here, Assad is trying to rebrand himself as the guy who can fight ISIS.
Yeah.
Is there any appetite for that? Anything you can tell us about if Iran would be part of that strategy if it developed?
That's a great point, Paul. Thank you. Let's remember how Iranian nationalism works. During the Iran-Iraq war, the clergy could go to Evin prison, the most famous political prison in Tehran, and say to communists and other opposition figures who were in prison, say, look, we'll let you out if you go and fight the Iraqis. Do it for your country. You'll be surprised that the vast majority did. Political opponents came out of prison, went and fought the Iraqis. As soon as the Iraqi forces were thrown out of Iranian territory, we see a major drop in number of volunteers for the war effort. My point is, Iranian nationalism really at heart is about defending the homeland. What's happening in Syria has nothing to do with the homeland. Ordinary Iranians and the Revolutionary Guards people know that. This is why they're so desperate to, you know, every time there's a fallen comrade, they have all the show on in the media and so on. They know the appetite back home for this intervention should not be tested too much. The reports, I don't know how much of this is true or not, but certainly reports of Khamenei having ordered at least a number of the IRGC people to come home might be an indication that they are aware about the base back home. How might they react to, Iranian, not just boys, because let's face it, most of those boys who are going to Syria are volunteers. Nobody from the conscripted armed forces has been sent to Syria. And if they want to go and die for the cause, well, good luck to them. But what about the money? When you have Iranian pensioners, like we've seen in recent weeks, come out in the streets and openly shout, keep our money at home, no more money for Syria, you're talking about a social phenomenon back home that could come and bite the regime from within. So I think there is definitely a factor here that you don't want to be overstretching yourself. And, you know, Iran has done this in the region in the past, but you can't compare southern Lebanon and Hezbollah with taking over a country the size of Syria. It's just simply too huge. So I think, yes, they can talk the talk, but in effect, they are worried about the home. And I'll say one final thing about this. I mentioned this in my remarks. Ayatollah Khamenei is 77 years old. When he passes on, IRGC generals need all the men they can have back home ready for that power struggle that's going to take place. Having guys fighting ISIS in Syria is not going to cut it for him because they might just lose the supreme leadership position to one of Rouhani, could actually be Rouhani himself. So I think these factors, certainly need to be kept in mind.
Thank you, Alex. Let's take a number of questions from the floor. The gentleman in the second row. Introduce yourself and...
I'm Yusuf Ismail. I'm from the Washington Kurdish Institute. Ambassador Ford, I hoped you would mention the breach of ceasefire by the National Coalition in northern Aleppo in Sheikh Maksud, where hundreds of Kurds and Arabs been killed by these groups. And I'm happy to provide videos of the hell cannons bombarding on their homes. Last year spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the moderate groups. It vanished in a couple of days. And as we know, YPG has lost 4,000 lives in the fight against ISIS. Here's my question. Is it bad for the U.S. to support Kurdish federalism similar to the Iraqi Kurdistan where security, stability made the U.S. facilitate freely there? And also, given that the Rojava administration has called to host all the Syrian refugees in their areas, similar to KRG where they host 1.8 million displaced IDPs and refugees.
If thank you.
Talk about that. Thank
ask
you.
My panelists to make notes of the questions. We'll take other questions. The lady in the fourth row.
Hi, I'm Mona Alami from the Atlantic Council. I'm a non-resident fellow there. My question is, we've heard a lot about the different
players. Is it addressed to any particular?
No, maybe to Ambassador Ford and Charles Lister. What is the feeling about the Saudi support to Arab rebel groups? From what I've been hearing from rebel groups, the support is declining. There isn't as much support as it used to before. And Charles mentioned that there was a meeting, and several meetings in Turkey, where Saudi Arabia ordered the groups to support the HNC. So do you feel that Saudi is changing or is maybe being less bold on Syria?
Thank you. Question, gentlemen in the third row.
Thanks, Paul. I'm Benjamin Norman from the British Embassy. I mean, it's for the entire panel, but probably for Ambassador Ford and for Charles Moore. I wanted to ask about how toxic Russia's brand in Syria, but also perhaps, you know, in Turkey, there's a slightly different issue there, but in Iran as well, was becoming as a result of their intervention in Russia. So in a 5-month period, they've Russian airstrikes have killed well over 1,000 civilians. They've hit schools, hospitals, bakeries. We know because the British government built it and the Russian government bombed it. You know, what impact is that having? We talk a lot about how Assad can never be part of the solution in Syria because of what he's done. Can Russia have a role in Syria going forward, given what they've done over the past 5 months and indeed over the past 5 years?
Thank you. Gentleman in the fourth row.
Thanks very much. My name is Tyler Thompson. I'm with United for a Free Syria. My question is for the Syria guys on the left here. So this morning we heard reports that the Assad government bombed the parts of Idlib, one of the cities where these anti-Nusra, anti-Assad protests were happening. Of course, the regime and probably the Russians would say, well, you know, that part of Idlib is in Nusra-controlled area, so therefore it's fair game. You know, in the parameters of the ceasefire. So my question is sort of, we're all sort of looking at these groups that are coming out to protest in the ceasefire. How fragile is that if the regime and Russians can just bomb them? Thanks.
Thank you. Question in the second row, and then we'll go to our panel.
Hi, my name is Mahmoud Nurzai. I'm from Afghanistan. My question is to Ambassador Ford. When Russia entered the conflict in Syria, how surprising that was for the United States, and how that has changed the dynamics of relationship between the region. And then later on, we had the axis of Russia, Iran, Syria as an alliance fighting Islamic States, but mainly targeting the Syrian opposition. So if you could tell us what the U.S. long-term strategy will be in Syria, and if there is one, apart from the current one that we see, that Assad has to resign and the Syrian opposition has to enter the negotiation. So in the broader context, the relationship between Turkey, Russia, and vis-a-vis the Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Russia. So if you could narrate on that part.
Thank you, Mahmoud. I'll turn to the panel. Robert, you've been the main target and victim of questions, so...
I thought you were supposed to protect me, Paul. That was the when I came down from Vermont,
shield.
That was the deal. With respect to the gentleman who asked about the Kurds, you know, the United States and the Iraqi Kurdish regional government have had a very good relationship for years. We have a diplomatic post there, and we are providing a variety of kinds of assistance to our friends in the Kurdish regional government. We do not have the same relationship with the PYD, obviously. And the PYD is not the only Syrian Kurdish actor. There's also the Kurdish National Congress. There are other actors. There haven't been elections in a way where all Kurds could run in a free and fair process. So with respect to your question, I think looking at the Syrian Kurdish issue, declaring an autonomous zone without coordinating it with other elements of the Syrian population, doing it in a unilateral way, is certainly going to raise conflict. And it did in Iraq, too. That conflict, by the way, is not resolved. If you think it's resolved, look at Hawija outside of Kirkuk, which has been a recruitment area, first for al-Qaeda and later for the Islamic State. So rather than declaring it unilaterally, it would be much better to bring that kind of a question of an autonomous zone, a Syrian issue, not an American issue, a Syrian issue, into a broader discussion of the political future of Syria. And of course, the PYD has to be included in that conversation about Syria's political future. Of course, the PYD has to be included. But declaring it unilaterally, in my opinion, is politically a mistake, and for the United States, it's a threat. It aggravates our challenge of containing the Islamic State in Syria. Another gentleman over here asked about the American reaction to Russian intervention and the American long-term strategy. And I have to say, the American goal for Syria of restoring stability in Syria and getting a new government of some kind, that's the American goal. I'm at something of a loss as to what the American strategy, this administration's strategy is. I know they want a deal in Geneva. What they're actually doing to leverage a deal is not clear to me. This has always been, for me, the mismatch between the goal and the strategy and the tactics. I think the United States was not so surprised that Russia went in, but there was, of course, the idea that it would be a quagmire for the Russians. But that was based on two assumptions. First assumption was that there would be increased assistance to the Syrian opposition, and the Russians would end up fighting a harder and more capable opposition. That assistance does not seem to have materialized last October, November, December. One of the other people asking questions talked about an apparent reduction in Saudi support. So, and the second is that the Russians had a very limited tactical goal of restoring stability on the battlefront. Assad was losing. Russians intervene, stabilize Assad, and then they withdraw. So there is no quagmire. The Russians were a textbook example of how to use limited military force for a tactical objective that supports a political objective, and then they withdraw. My hat is off to the Russians for understanding the interplay between force and diplomacy.
Yes, thank you all for the great questions. I would just say, because I think the Sheikh Maksoud wasn't mentioned, I mean, I think I'm aware that there are hell cannon attacks going on targeting Sheikh Maksoud neighborhood in particular, and obviously those should be classified as ceasefire violations. I am also aware of allegations that fire is going the other direction too. So, and it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, because I've seen videos of both sides firing against each other. But both sides should be considered ceasefire violations, or whatever action takes place is taking place against an agreement. In terms of Saudi support for armed opposition, it's fluctuated. I think what the Saudis have done at the moment now is they've bought into the political process. By necessity, they need to have a prominent role in facilitating the HNC's role in the process itself, but also in terms of managing the armed opposition's role within the political process. And in that regard, what was interesting is certainly in the 2 weeks roughly before the cessation of hostilities started, all armed groups across northern Syria reported very significant increases in shipment supplies. So essentially what seems to have taken place is the supplies dramatically increased prior to the ceasefire so that they could stockpile and wait for whenever it breaks down. And that's what people are telling me now. We've got loads of stuff waiting. We have lots of good equipment. We have new things that we apparently haven't had before, is what they've said. But they're not using it because the hostilities are that much reduced. So for now, Saudi is focused on the political process. Russia's brand toxicity. I think what's been fascinating working in track two work with the armed opposition in particular is that consistently the armed opposition has said negotiating with Iran is an existential issue for us. Like Iran and Assad are extraordinarily difficult challenges that we just don't know how that's going to work. But Russia is someone that we could negotiate with. We understand what Russia's interests are. We understand that Russia's interests are more limited perhaps than Iran and then certainly than the Assad regime. What's interesting is that since Russia's intervention, that has become a little bit questionable. They still say we can negotiate with the Russians, but certainly their actions in killing at least 1,000 civilians in their active part of the intervention has negatively damaged that that role on that or that brand. But I think still, although it will be more tough, the idea that they can still negotiate with the Russians is still there. And then finally on Marta Numan, the bombings this morning, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, if we see it for a few days, then we can draw a pretty definitive conclusion. Looking at just this morning's bombings in isolation, I would say it's not exactly surprising. I mean, it's kind of textbook regime strategy. So the cessation of hostilities has seen popular revolutionary ideals resume. That's not in the regime's interest, because it's the opposition's way of trying to show the world that we're still moderate and we still have the same ideals we had in 2011. And at the same time, the decline in a group like Jabhat al-Nusra is not in the regime's interest either, because their entire brand is predicated on fighting terrorism. So if you take a cynical view, you would say these bombings are nothing but predictable. They're targeting a town which has risen up against extremism for nearly 3 weeks. It will be 3 weeks tomorrow. Is textbook regime strategy.
Gudur Alex want to add something from these questions?
There was a question about what the Russian involvement would mean for Turkey. Well, three things. A de facto no-fly zone in northern Syria, which helped the Kurdish groups gain ground. And second, it strengthened the regime. Of course, before the Russians intervened in September 2015, Turkey and Qatar-backed Syrian opposition groups were gaining ground in the north. And third, Turkey always feared that there would be some kind of cooperation between Washington and Moscow that would shift the focus away from the regime. And in the, according to the ruling party in Turkey, that's exactly what happened after Russia intervened in Syria. Americans and Russians, they started coordinating flights, and that was that type of cooperation that Turkey has always feared. But of course, this picture got more complicated after Turkey downed the Russian jet. The Russian involvement posed a bigger problem for Turkey. But on the other hand, there was another question on Turkey-Russia relations. So going forward, I think Russia is a very important country for Turkey. It's dependent on Russia for its energy needs. And also, Russian actions are really complicating everything in Turkey, not just in Syria, but also in Armenia and its immediate neighborhood. I mean, Turkey was trying to sell its goods to Russia through Iran, and Russia was pressuring Iran to stop doing that. So it's complicating many things for Turkey, and I think Turkey has been doing a lot to mend ties. Just yesterday, when President Erdogan delivered his remarks at Brookings, he said the same thing, that Turkey really values its relations with Russia, and it wants to mend ties with Russia. And we've seen some signs. Just yesterday, for instance, the person who allegedly killed the Russian pilot after the Turks downed the Russian jet was arrested in Turkey, and that was a long-time demand, Russian demand. And also we've seen a military delegation, Russian military delegation, that visited Turkey just a few days ago. So I think both parties are working towards mending the ties.
Thank you. No, we have to move on. Alex, you can talk after the event. Alex?
Sure. Very quick. I think the only question was on Russia for me. So I just wanted to say, since August 2013, the Rouhani government, the Putin people have been talking a lot about cooperation on all sorts of levels. But the fact is, 2.5 years of close rhetorical sort of cooperation like that doesn't wash away over 2 centuries of Iranian-Russian sort of animosity. I mean, we shouldn't forget most of the Caucasus was lost by the Persian Empire to the Russians. I can guarantee you a lot of folks still remember that. Syria is obviously a factor. But the Iranians do look at Russian actions elsewhere as well. So a lot of talk, for instance, to be very specific, on energy cooperation, but nothing's happened. 2 years of talks about oil swap, nothing's happened. And finally, I can almost guarantee you the Iranians are more careful about watching Russia's steps on the delivery of the so-called S-300 anti-air missile systems by the Russians to Iran than what Russia does in Syria. Because apparently if the rumors are true, if the Israelis were the ones who stopped the Russians from giving those missiles to the Iranians, well, it makes it very clear for Iran that this is not some sort of a great strategic alliance in the making, very much a tactical one, limited to Syria for now, but God knows what happens once Syria is done. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Any last quick questions? I'll go to the gentleman here and here and here.
My name is Emily. I'm from the Rumsfeld Fellowship Program. My question is basically about U.S. foreign policy. What do you really think is happening with the current U.S. foreign policy? We have a feeling that it's being lost in the region recently because with relations to the regional countries, once they have been really strategic partners, we can take Turkey and U.S. relations started deteriorating. We have another feeling that there is a quantity versus the quality in the agenda of the U.S. foreign policy, basically making more deals like the Iranian deal, just without following up, without doing some further, deals to push forward. And as well, the same applies to our region, the Caucasus in Azerbaijan, because recently we had a crisis with the with U.S. and Azerbaijan relations. Basically, we have been cooperating in many, many areas, energy security, anti-terrorism in the region. We have been giving a lot of support to U.S. and just stopped much support from the U.S. in our energy projects and all these type of things. I mean, basically, there is a confusion.
Thank you. Okay, question's clear. In the 6th, 7th row.
Yeah, I don't need the microphone.
We need it for, we're recording this. It'll be later on our website, so it's...
Okay, no problem.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Alec Emmert, former military officer with a little bit of experience in the region. And the big question I have is directed more towards Charles. If not al-Assad, then who? Should his regime be removed from power? What will replace it? And what is the risk that an extremist government with ties to al-Nusra will take power?
Thank you. Last question from the gentleman in the second row.
Thank you very much. My name is Barry Salam. I'm from Afghanistan. I want to know from the panelists, from their experience of ISIS operations assessment, what are the chances and possibilities of the ISIS operations spreading over to Iran and also Pakistan and Afghanistan, since Pakistan has been the breeding ground for terrorism, radicalism for the past 30 years. So they don't have a strong foothold there, but there are a lot of sympathizers. So
thank you. Let's turn back to our panel, take it in the other order. Alex, let me start with you about the Azeri question, also possibly Iran-Pakistan, the last question.
I mean, my quick point on that one is obviously it's clear that a lot of countries in the region are looking to this U.S. government and are scratching their heads. But I just want to make a very quick point. I always say this in the region, be less emotional when you look at the United States foreign policy pursuits and look at what U.S. interests are at that moment in time. And I think, in the case of Azerbaijan, I think Azerbaijan is a country that is a strategic ally of the United States, has done plenty for the United States. I'm not saying everything Azerbaijan is perfect. We all know lots needs to be done. But if you look at what Azerbaijan did in terms of supporting U.S. military efforts in Afghanistan, energy security, all the rest of it has always been there. And, in the last few years, unfortunately, we've seen Azerbaijan-U.S. relations really deteriorate. Hopefully that will change. On the point with ISIS elsewhere, look, that's a great point. And if I was sitting in Iran, in Tehran, and I'm looking to countries to my east, Afghanistan, Pakistan, where you already obviously have Taliban in different versions operating, I would be very concerned. Because if Taliban was anti-Shia and anti-Iranian, ISIS is 100 times more. And if it finds a foothold in a country like Pakistan of 190 million people, nuclear armed, just imagine what that could potentially do, not just for sectarianism inside Pakistan that could spill over, but also as a launching pad for attacks within Iran. Let's not forget Iranian Balochistan, the province that borders Pakistan, is the only place in Iran where you actually have an active jihadist insurgency within Iran's borders. And they're being fed by elements in Pakistan. So yes, it's a real concern, absolutely real concern. Rouhani was just in Islamabad. Let's see if security cooperation, as they promise, is going to go anywhere and see. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. Charles, let me turn to you. A couple of questions on.
Sure.
If not Assad, who and ISIS spreading?
Yeah, on the first one, if not Assad, who, whether or not it's going to be an extremist government led by al-Qaeda. If not Assad, who, firstly? I think that the best and the only alternative, albeit it would be a very messy one, is something along the lines of what the Geneva communique originally thought out. The idea of what would essentially be in today's dynamics a long drawn out transition that will eventually transfer into a transitional governing body, a TGB, which the opposition still talks about a lot today, that would in and of itself be fully representative of all components of Syrian society. Much as my presentation made a big deal of jihadist militants, and that I believe is justified, the reality still, in my view, and from my experience talking with well over 1,000 highly influential Syrians over the last 2.5 years, is that there just isn't a popular support for the idea of an extremist government led by al-Qaeda. It's just not going to happen, right? The dynamics within the conflict of today have meant for a long time that people have been too afraid of coming out against groups like Jabhat al-Nusra. But that doesn't mean they're not against them. And so we are now starting to see, now that the conflict, as I said in my presentation, has reduced, people coming out and doing exactly that, protesting against them. So it's going to be long, it's going to be messy, however it happens, but I have witnessed firsthand the potential for bringing in all aspects of Syrian society into a shared transitional governing body, and then rewriting a constitution. I have seen that work as well on track two levels. So I know it can be done, but I know it's going to be very, very long and messy. On the other hand, you can also make the argument that Russia may be pushing for a long-term alternative that it itself would find acceptable. And by rehabilitating the regime's reputation internationally, Russia may eventually pivot to ask the West essentially to accept what it would see in Moscow as an acceptable alternative to Bashar al-Assad, and that would almost certainly be a militarily connected general of some sort. But I don't think that will end up happening. Just very briefly on ISIS and expanding. I mean, it already has, as you say, a small foothold in Afghanistan. It's Khorasan province. I would have said 6 months ago it had quite a lot of potential to continue to expand that foothold. But what's been quite interesting is that both the Taliban, also the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, and Afghan security forces have all pushed back in different areas quite successfully against ISIS's small foothold. So as of now, within current dynamics, I think they're actually struggling to acquire something genuinely significant. But in the long term, with a continued reduction in US and other Western involvement in the security apparatus, and increasing reports of a lack of equipment within Afghan security forces in particular, I certainly wouldn't discount the possibility that they'll find somewhere to try and essentially rebuild and try again a phase two in Afghanistan. Iran, I don't necessarily see it happening. I think it's been quite interesting, more than anything, that ISIS has not targeted Iran really at all, apart from ground-to-ground fighting in Iraq. They just haven't turned their sights on Iran beyond rhetoric. And I think actually they would see that as a risk too far in actually targeting Iranian assets, whether they be Iranian assets outside of Iran or inside Iranian territory.
Thank you, Charles. Robert, there was a question about U.S. policy. And as a former U.S. And is like not having a strategy as strategy?
Well,
as some people say?
I think for those here who have not read the president's interview with Jeff Goldberg in The Atlantic, let me just join dozens of other people in Washington who have said it's just incredibly worth reading. It's a long interview, but that makes it all the more valuable. And I think the president has explained the administration's policy clearly, which is that they would like fewer military entanglements in the Middle East, and they would like to be able to devote more time and resources to developing relations with Asia. That's a strategy. That's a global geopolitical strategy. You can agree with it, disagree with it. But that is, I think, what they are trying to do. And I think, frankly, the rise of the Islamic State and the threat that it poses to not only friends in Europe, but also directly to us, I think has impeded the administration's ability to devote more time and attention to developing relationships in Asia. I am not sure what the next administration will do with respect to balancing and prioritizing between the Middle East and other parts of the world. I mean, we are still a superpower and we have interests around the world, not only in the Middle East.
Thank you, Robert. Gunil, do you add anything? You're good? Okay. Well, I'd urge you all, before thanking our panel, visit our website, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, subscribe. You can even become paying members and help us support work like this. Otherwise, please join me in thanking our panelists for an excellent panel.